a very substantive agenda today with Oregon Law Commission bills. And at this time, we're going to take all the bills at once in order to accommodate Senator Brown's schedule, and then we'll close that hearing and take up the bills one by one. So at this time, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 229, 230, 231, 232, 233, and 234. Welcome, Senator Brown.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And for the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown, represent Senate District 21, Portland and Milwaukee, and just delighted to be here for my first time in front of the very famous Senate Judiciary Committee, which I just broke the mic.
They'll be fine for that.
I don't even know how many years now, I've served as the Vice Chair of the Oregon Law Commission and have chaired the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group. As all of you know, the Oregon Law Commission was created by statute during the 1997 Legislative Assembly to help the legislature conduct a continuous substantive law revision program. And we're very fortunate to have a commission that brings together some of the finest legal minds in Oregon to help us accomplish this very important task. I would like to take a moment to recognize the Law Commission staff. The Deputy Director, Wendy Johnson, was here a moment ago. She's still here. And the Executive Director, Dave Kanegi, is here as well. And they just do outstanding work.
Welcome to both of you.
I am also just delighted to have all of our folks, or most of our folks, from the Juvenile Code Rewrite behind me. This group has met continuously for over 4 years. We have about 45 to 50 members of the Juvenile Code Rewrite. We meet regularly the third Friday of the month and have done so for several years. The group represents the continuous spectrum of folks involved in the juvenile justice system, from lawyers to judges, to caseworkers, mental health providers, DAs. You get the gist. So these folks have spent incredible amount of hours, volunteer hours, working these bills, and I just have to thank them. They don't get paid, and they get very little glory, and the state owes them our debt of gratitude. They've just done an amazing job. I also have a couple of judges here today, the Honorable Terry Legert, Marion County Circuit Court Judge, and I believe the Honorable Deanne Darling from Clackamas County Circuit Court will be joining us. We also have a number of other experts, but I would ask that you welcome them as well. The bills we are hearing before you include the following. Senate Bill 229, which is the intervention bill cleanup. Linda Guss from the AG's office will be testifying on this bill. It clarifies the existing law relating to dependency proceedings in juvenile court by requiring that the court give preference in placement of the child to a person who has been a caregiver to that child. Basically, the bill fixes cross-reference and technical wording problems in the statute. I hope that should be a fairly straightforward measure for you. Senate Bill 230, parents with guardian ad litem, Julie McFarlane from Juvenile Rights Projects, and Pete Miller will be testifying. Right now, the Juvenile Code lacks a provision that adequately addresses the issues of the appointment and role of a guardian ad litem for a parent in a dependency or termination of parental rights proceeding. This bill arose from attorney uncertainty regarding ethical responsibilities of appointments of guardian ad litem. Senate Bill 230 addresses the lack of clarity in the law and remedies the confusion that exists in the role of a guardian ad litem in juvenile dependency proceedings. Senate Bill 231 is confidentiality of juvenile court records. Mike Livingston from the Department of Justice will be testifying. The Juvenile Code lacks clarity regarding confidentiality of juvenile court records, defining what is part of the court record for purposes of appeal, and designating who is required to maintain the records. We believe Senate Bill 231 clarifies these issues. Senate Bill 232 creates what is called as a Juvenile Psychiatric Security Review Board. This is a rewrite from a bill from last session. There are a number of people testifying. I won't introduce them all. But currently, juveniles have a constitutional right to raise an insanity defense in a criminal proceeding. But the Oregon Juvenile Code is silent as to options for youth who successfully assert this defense. While the Psychiatric Security Review Board supervises kids as adults in similar situations, there's no process to oversee the assignment, supervision, and monitoring of youth. The bill seeks to establish a juvenile panel of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. Folks have been working on this bill since the year 2000. We really would appreciate your support and its passage. Senate Bill 233, Juvenile Code Split Cleanup. This bill updates the language in ORS Chapter 419C. 486 regarding case planning and delinquency cases that was written when delinquency and dependency law were based upon the best interest of the child standard. Timothy Travis from the State Court Administrator's Office, Juvenile Court Improvement Project, and Karen Andahl will be testifying. Karen's with the Oregon Youth Authority. They'll be testifying on this bill. And last but not least, Senate Bill 234, Putative Father Rights. We have Ms. K.T. Garrett from the Department of Justice and Professor Leslie Harris from the University of Oregon School of Law. This bill deals with a number of technical difficulties and statutes, but biological fathers who have demonstrated a commitment to the responsibilities of parenthood have certain constitutional rights regarding notice in juvenile court proceedings involving their children. Presently, the Oregon revised statutes do not reflect the constitutional standard, and there are inconsistencies throughout the statutes. Senate Bill 234 remedies these problems by bringing the statutory provisions regarding putative fathers in line with constitutional requirements and by giving juvenile courts the appropriate authority to resolve paternity disputes. So with that, I would be happy to answer any questions, though I would, of course, prefer to defer to the certified smart people sitting behind me.
Thank you. And thank you, Senator Brown, for your long-standing work on this. I know
Thanks.
This has been a labor of love for you for years and years,
and we
really appreciate your effort. Are there questions of Senator Brown? Senator Beyer, come on.
He's just looking like he has a question, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much,
thank
Senator
you.
Brown.
And I wish you the best of luck in tackling these issues. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. At this time, we will close the hearing on these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 bills, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 233. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 233 amends the language regarding the purpose of the Oregon Youth Authority and what it is to use for its case planning for youth within its jurisdiction. There are several other technical amendments to the language, and they basically all change the language of the statutes concerning OIA to reflect the public policy of public safety, accountability, and reformation principles since the split of the Oregon Juvenile Code took place.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Timothy Travis. I work with the Oregon Judicial Department. My title is I'm the Court Improvement Manager. I tried to think long and hard about what I'm going to say here today because you are going on a ride this afternoon through the Juvenile Code. Juvenile law, child abuse and neglect, and delinquency law are the absolute most complicated and esoteric bodies of law in the ORS. I very frequently train caseworkers, judges, and other players in the juvenile system, and I always have to start out giving an overview of what I'm going to talk about because the juvenile code, the tax code is a walk in the park compared to the juvenile code. We're here today on Senate Bill 233 to talk about some adjustments, essentially, to the statute, which have been necessitated by 15 years of history of the juvenile code. The good news is I'm not going to relate the entire 15 years worth of history to you. That actually is included, a summary of it is included in the materials that you have. The sad part about that is that I wrote those materials from memory. I've been there, as many people in this group have been there, for that 15 years of history. Essentially what Senate Bill 233 does is it focuses on kids after they've been adjudicated as delinquents. And the next step, once we've adjudicated someone as being a delinquent, that person becomes a youth offender. That's what we call them now, youth offenders. And we have to have a case plan for how we are going to treat their condition, how we are going to try to rehabilitate them. A case plan. The other thing that this bill deals with, aside from the case plan itself, is the process by which we review the case. Because once a youth offender is adjudicated to be a youth offender and we start to treat them, we also check up on the progress of that youth offender throughout the time that they're within the system. And the reason that we have to update this language dealing with both case plans and with the review process is that the case planning statute that we have today and the review process statutes that we have today were all written at a time when the watchword, the pole star, the organizing principle, whatever you want to call it, of juvenile law and dealing with delinquents at that time was, we are going to do what's in the best interest of the child. And that was what we looked as our measuring stick. That was our policy. We're operating within the best interest of the child. And that's because there was a time, 25 years ago, when there was a consensus in American society, essentially, that juvenile delinquency and child abuse and neglect were two sides of the same coin. And that the juvenile delinquency was a manifestation of child abuse and neglect. Now, in the last 25 years, our society has laid down that understanding and separated child abuse and neglect from delinquency. And we no longer, as a matter of policy, believe that child abuse and neglect and juvenile delinquency have that inherent connection. And now we deal with child abuse and neglect under the pole star of the best interest of the child. We want to do what's in the best interest of the child. But when we're dealing with delinquent youth today, we want to deal with public safety, accountability, and rehabilitation. The statutes that we propose to amend in Senate Bill 233 deal with delinquent children, delinquent youth offenders. But the statute still refers to them and refers to the process as though we're dealing with dependent children. So the language is changed. Words like treatment are changed to custody. And words like that. I don't want to spend a lot of time with the technical aspects of this bill and walk you through the pieces piece by piece because you have written materials that explain that and what they're doing. That's the background of what we were accomplishing with Senate Bill 233. And in the interest of time, there are so many people who have so much to say to you today. I'd like to just kind of stop there, and if you have any questions, I'd like to answer those. But otherwise, I'd like to keep it short. Are there any questions that you have?
Thank you, Mr. Travis. We have a -2 amendment here, and it looks like it's almost a substitute for the original bill.
It is. It's a comprehensive amendment, yes.
Yes. It was. Your comments are really directed to the -2 amendment. Is that correct?
Yes.
Thank
you. Yes, they are, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Next.
Thank you, Chair and members. My name is Karen Andel. I'm with the Oregon Youth Authority, and my role here is to be available for answering any technical questions related to the bill as might pertain to OYA, the Oregon Youth Authority, and I've been a member of the subcommittee that has worked on this bill, so I'm available for questions or clarification if you need them.
Thank you very much. Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Is this bill going to change the way Oregon Youth Authority handles youth? Because I'm seeing in the staff measure summary what the bill does. It requires the youth authority to use case planning for youth within the jurisdiction. Is that what you're already doing, and this is clarifying that, or is this a significant change?
Chair Burdick, Senator Beyer. Actually, the youth authority has, since its inception, complied with the requirements of Senate Bill 1, which relate, as Mr. Travis mentioned, to public safety, accountability, and reformation. So basically, we have been working with youth, developing reformation plans as per statute in the context as is described in these amendments. This basically makes it very clear that we will have case plans, that we will report those on those case plans to the court, and that the case plans will surround those three areas and be pertinent to those three areas of public safety, reformation, and accountability.
I do think, Senator Beyer, that you summed it up.
Mm-hmm.
We are conforming the statute to practice.
The follow-up question, and maybe more to Joe, I see it says there is no fiscal impact, and I assume that is because this is the way, because it sounds, if you read the bill summaries, it sounds like this is going to be a huge cost driver. But if this is what you're already doing, that would explain why there's no fiscal impact.
I can certainly confirm that there's no fiscal impact that's been issued by the fiscal legislative fiscal office. I can't speak to whether or not the statute, the statutory change is merely going to conform to practice. I think based on what I heard Ms. Andahl say, the answer to your question is that it is not going to change anything that OIA is currently doing. It is just going to make more clear and more clean that this is the purpose that OIA must live up to. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, Senator, the statute as it was written, when it was written, there was no such thing as a reformation plan. And so there's now a reference to a reformation plan put into the statute. It's that level of change. But the reformation plans have been written since the Youth Authority came into existence.
Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 233 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 230.
Nope, I'm not. 230 is next. Sorry. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 230 would establish a specific procedure for the appointment of guardian ad litems for individuals who are incapacitated, either physically or mentally, who are parties to a juvenile dependency matter as parents or a termination of parental rights matter.
Good afternoon, Chair Burdick and committee members. My name is Peter Miller. I'm an attorney in Portland. I've been practicing law in juvenile court since I became a lawyer in 1982, and juvenile practice has become a majority of my work since that time. I defend parents and have represented parents in dependency cases who have had guardians ad litem appointed. I have, in probably, I'm not sure the exact number, but probably in 15 cases, served as a guardian ad litem.
Excuse me, could you pull the mic a little closer and maybe speak up just a little bit? We don't have the greatest sound system. Thank you.
You bet. I'm here to speak in favor of Senate Bill 230 and just give an idea of what it has been like to serve as a guardian ad litem or an attorney representing a parent with a guardian ad litem in the absence of any real statutory guidance. In my experience, there's sort of four different problems. One is, you know, what is the standard for appointing a guardian? Another is, what is the procedure for appointing a guardian? Another is, what is the relationship between the guardian ad litem and the attorney for the parent? Or in some instances, it's been the attorney for the guardian ad litem, not consistency in that regard even. And what is the scope of authority of a guardian ad litem? And to date, we have really only two cases in Oregon that address the issue of a guardian ad litem. And they deal with such basic questions that they really don't provide any meaningful guidance to a lawyer or a guardian ad litem. One is State versus Evgen, which is a 1991 case in which a parent who was mentally ill and was hospitalized, and the hospital refused to transport them to a hearing. That parent had their rights terminated in their absence for failing to show up. Court said that's a violation of due process. They're entitled to meaningful participation, should have had guardian ad litem. The other case would be a State versus Cooper, in which a parent at a termination of parental rights proceeding had a guardian ad litem. The parent, presumably because of her mental illness, failed to show up. The guardian ad litem on her behalf requested a trial, and the judge terminated the guardian ad litem's appointment and terminated the parent's rights for failing to be there. And the Court of Appeals said no, under the statute, current statute, the guardian ad litem is there to speak for the parent, and even though the parent's absent, it was error to terminate the parental rights over the guardian ad litem's objection. the problem, one of the problems with the fact that there has not been any real legal guidance for guardian ad litems has been that it does lead to inconsistent results. When I'm initially appointed for a parent, to be a guardian ad litem for a parent, I frequently find that the procedure, if you want to call it that the judge has gone through in concluding the parent needs a guardian item, varies greatly. Sometimes it's a formal hearing where there's an evaluation requested. Sometimes it's a mere statement from somebody that the parent is hospitalized and not present, and the court will go ahead and appoint a guardian ad litem, or based on a bare report, which references an evaluation that says the parent is not competent. So there's a great deal of variety in terms of the way that, in my experience, judges and referees approach the issue of when to appoint a guardian ad litem. It's also it's difficult, particularly at critical points in a termination or a dependency case, it's difficult to know how to proceed. In a dependency case that, for instance, is you're at the point of going to trial and you have a severely mentally ill parent, and the guardian ad litem is been looked to make a decision about how to proceed, it's not clear what your authority is. Can you admit the allegations against the parent, or can you waive the right to trial? Can you stipulate the evidence? Do you have to ask for a contested trial in every case? There's no guidance there, and it's a difficult decision to determine. And when working with attorneys who are representing the parent, you know, frequently the first thing that comes out of their mouth when you start working on a case as a guardian ad litem is, you know, what does this mean and how does this work and what do we do? And yeah, without any real law in the area, you know, there's not much the guardian ad litem can say to the attorney other than, I really don't know, this is how I do it, and go from there. And I guess finally, scope of authority. I think there's a little question that you have the authority as a guardian ad litem to make certain decisions in the course of the dependency case itself, but has not at all been clear if you have the authority to sign releases of information on behalf of the individual for records to go to other, you know, agencies. Do you have the authority to negotiate an open adoption agreement for a parent in a termination of parental rights case? Do you have the authority to sign relinquishments of parental rights in a termination case to settle it? So those are open questions. I think that this bill, Senate Bill 230, while any legislation always raises its own issues, but I think it will be terrific assistance to lawyers representing parents and to guardians ad litem, in that it gives a good framework and addresses all of the areas that I've talked about in terms of the sort of murky law in this area. So I am asking that I am speaking in support of it, and I thank you for the opportunity to do that, and if there are any questions, I'd be happy to do my best to answer them.
Thank you very much. For the non-lawyers on this panel, what is the literal meaning of the term ad litem? I think we know what you mean from the usage of it, but what does it actually mean? This is a law school exam.
I think it means a guardian for the litigation, is my understanding. As I recall, I was actually the attorney for the appellant in the Cooper case, And I think the court noted that there's nowhere in the law, I think it's in a dictionary, but there's really nowhere in the law in Oregon where it's defined. So we're using a term that doesn't have a definition in Oregon law, at least at this point.
Because it's a Latin term, I assume, ad litem.
Ad litem is, yes.
Okay. Well, if anybody wants to elucidate that at some future time, feel welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Julie McFarlane. I'm a supervising attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland. We are a law firm that represents children in juvenile court. And I also have been a member of the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group of the Oregon Law Commission for the last 4 years, and I chaired the sub-work group on Senate Bill 230, the guardian ad litem issue. We were the last sub-work group to be approved by the commission and started our work in April and met very regularly, once or twice a month between then and the bill being submitted. And we had good attendance and a well-rounded committee that represented all the different aspects of the folks who work in juvenile court proceedings. We were really pleased to also have Mr. Miller and a couple of other people on the sub-work group who actually serve as guardians ad litem so that they could help us with this legislation. We did a lot of research looking both at case law and statutes from other states, and one of the things that we found is that there is very little other statutory authority to draw on to look at developing a bill for guardians ad litem. There is quite a bit of case law, but that is generally focused on fairly narrow issues. So we believe that this bill actually could be a model for other states. In doing this bill, we made inquiries on a number of juvenile law listservs about procedure and statutes in other states, and a number of people responded indicating that they also needed similar legislation in their state and would look forward to our draft bill. With that, I will just walk you very quickly through the bill. Section 1 of the bill, of course, puts these provisions into Chapter 419B, the Juvenile Dependency Code. And Section 2, Subsection 1, starts out by indicating who can make a motion for the appointment of a guardian ad litem in a proceeding, in a juvenile proceeding, and that is any party to the proceeding or the judge, the juvenile court itself, can make that motion. Subsection 2 defines when the court must grant a motion for a hearing on the issue of whether a guardian ad litem should be appointed, and so that the information that has to be provided to the court are facts that establish that it is more probable than not that the parent, due to mental or physical disability, lacks substantial capacity to either understand the nature and consequence of the proceedings or give direction and assistance to the parent's attorney on decisions the parent must make. And so that's sort of the standard, and that actually appears in several places throughout the bill and is a little different from the kind of standard we see in a criminal case where we're talking about the defendant's ability to aid and assist, but basically follows along similar lines in terms of the capacity to understand, first of all, and then the capacity to give direction and assistance to counsel. In subsection 3, what the court must find in order to proceed to have a hearing on the issue of whether a guardian ad litem is appointed is set out, and that's that the court must have a reasonable belief that the parent, due to mental or physical disability, lacks that substantial capacity to either understand the nature and consequences of the proceeding or give direction and assistance to the parent's attorney on the decisions that the parent must make. In subsection 4, a hearing is required. In some cases now, when a guardian ad litem is appointed in a juvenile case, it is done ex parte without a hearing, and we felt because this involves very significant parental rights the possibility ultimately of termination and complete loss of relationship with the child, that it was important that there be a hearing and a full opportunity for the parent to present evidence on the issue of whether or not any mental or physical disability they have interferes with their capacity to basically conduct their own litigation without a guardian ad litem. In sub 4, we also indicate that the court can receive reports without regard to many of the rules of evidence except for relevancy. And this is a common practice in pretrial motions where you're making determinations such as these, and it is also a common practice in juvenile court and allowed by statute in other similar types of proceedings where you're making these determinations that are not the ultimate dispositions of the case. In subsection 5, we have we set forth the standard for the determination, which is by preponderance of the evidence that the court makes the determination that the guardian ad litem must be appointed for the parent. And in subsection 6, we provide that a decision made in a juvenile dependency case that a parent has a guardian ad litem cannot be used in evidence in other types of proceedings, either in the juvenile court case, in a civil commitment proceeding, or any other civil proceeding against the parent. In Section 3, we specify who can serve as a guardian ad litem, and basically that provides that it can be a licensed mental health professional, an attorney. It must be someone who is familiar with the legal standards relating to competence, and it must be someone who has skills and experience in representing persons with mental and physical disabilities, and it may not be a member of the parent's family. Section 3 provides that the guardian ad litem is not a party to the proceeding but is a representative of the parent. The current statute designates a guardian ad litem as a party to the proceeding, but after studying the issue, we felt it was appropriate that they not be a party but be rather a representative of a party to the parent. In subsection 3, we have -1 amendments, and I'll start to talk about those changes just as I go through, and we start to see those changes here in subsection 3. And the first one appears in and subsection 3 in general is talking about the duties of the guardian ad litem.
Excuse me, but let's hold off here and work from the -3 amendments here, which should be in the packet. Yeah, we don't have them.
We don't have 230s. I just put
231. Yeah, we don't have amendments yet. Maybe do you know were those amendments delivered to the staff? Had they been printed?
And we could ask Ms. John. Ms. Dotson is indicating that you should have the -1 amendments, but you don't.
Okay. I think it would probably would be better to wait until we have the -1 amendments before we start talking about subsection 3. Okay. And is that the only subsection that they apply to? Or?
Yes.
Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and describe subsection 4 then.
Okay. Subsection 4 then provides for the termination of the appointment of the guardian ad litem, and basically that appointment continues until it's terminated by the court, or the case is dismissed, or the parent's parental rights are terminated. And it is a provided that the court can continue the appointment of the guardian ad litem after termination of parental rights, and the purpose of that is that very often there is an effort to have an open adoption agreement negotiated that goes on after the official termination of parental rights. Excuse me. Subsection 2 provides for when it is necessary to remove...
You were on 4, and then the next one here is 5.
Right. Subsection 2 of Section 4.
Okay, well, that must be in the amendments then.
Page 3, line 6. Sub 2 of Section 4.
Right. Oh, you're talking about Section 4 now?
Right.
Okay, excuse me. I was looking at Subsection 4 on the previous page. Okay.
Yeah, Section 4, because I completely skipped Section 3.
Got it. I understand now.
Section 4, Subsection 2, provides that any party can request the removal of the guardian ad litem. So very often what happens in these cases is that a parent comes into court extremely mentally ill. Some help is gotten for them. They get on medication, and that improves their ability to direct their own litigation. They no longer need a guardian ad litem, and so at that point, any party can request the removal of the guardian ad litem. And the court is required to remove the guardian ad litem if the court determines that the parent no longer lacks substantial capacity to understand the nature and consequences of the proceeding or give direction to the parent's attorney. The court may also has authority to remove the guardian ad litem on other grounds as the court determines is appropriate. And then subsection 3 of Section 4 provides that the Public Defense Services Commission compensate guardians ad litem for their duties. PDSC currently compensates persons who are appointed as guardians ad litem for these tasks.
Okay, and now maybe we could go back to line 16 of under Section 3, Subsection 3, where the amendment kicks in.
Okay.
That's great. We all have the amendment now.
Then on line 16 in Subsection 3, Sub 3, after the word attorney, we're having inserted from the amendments and make any other inquiries as are appropriate to assist the guardian ad litem in making decisions in the juvenile court proceeding. So that provision basically says what a guardian ad litem is supposed to be doing in performing their duties, and we wanted to expand that, so not only would they talk to the parent if the parent's able to talk to them and talk to the attorney or the parent's attorney, but also that they could make other inquiries so that they could have enough information to make the decisions that they're charged with making in the case. The next amendment deletes line 17, the beginning of subsection B, and inserts a fairly lengthy amendment that sets out what the legal decisions are that the parent would ordinarily make and that now the guardian ad litem is being charged with making in the case. And we did this to provide specific guidance to guardians ad litem about that. So it sets forth that these decisions are whether to admit or deny the allegations of any petition, whether to agree to or contest jurisdiction, wardship, temporary commitment, guardianship, or permanent commitment, whether to accept or decline a conditional postponement, or whether to agree to or contest specific services or placement. And then we go back to the existing language.
Excuse me. Senator Starr, do you have a question?
I'm confused about that deletion of line 17 and adding a new sub B. Are you deleting all of sub B in the original, line 17, 18, 19, and 20, or are you just deleting line 17?
Sure. Just line 17. So at the very end of the section there on line 13 of the dash 1 amendments where it says make, and then that make goes to
make a whole sentence out of what starts on line 18.
So and make decisions concerning.
Yeah, make decisions concerning. So we added the list that's in the dash one amendments, but we're keeping the part that was already in there about making decisions relating to the adoption of the child.
Thank you for asking that, Senator Starr. I was struggling with the same thing myself. Does that clear it up for you?
Well, it... It does not clear it up because there's much more language there on 18, 19, and 20. It doesn't seem to fit with what you're seeing in the amendment.
Well, she's inserting the content of the amendment and then picking up line 18 by putting a make in front of the decision. So you take delete line 17 and insert all this other stuff
down to line 13.
Down to line 13, and then you add the word make, and then continue with that section. So that flows along. It's an odd way to do it. Usually we see it being completely deleted and just replaced, but. Did that confuse you further, well, Senator Starr?
There's something missing.
Senator Krasinski.
I had the same problem. If we start off where it says delete line 17 on the amendment line 4, mm-hmm. and it says insert, and if we put lines 5 through 12 in line 17's place, and then what's on the amendment on line 13 is the sub C make, and we put that right in front of the word decisions on line 18 of the bill. That is what they're trying to do. They're trying to maintain what's there. But, yeah, I agree. Clarity-wise, they should have just deleted it and just added where it would read easier.
Yeah.
It takes at least three readings.
Maybe we could ask the staff to hand engross this at some point for us. That might make it a little easier. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Hey.
Chair Burdick.
I agree. It took me a couple of readings to figure it out. But yes, so we're making a new subsection C. In subsection B, we're talking about the legal decisions that the parent would make relating to cases in juvenile court. So the jurisdictional case in juvenile court or the termination of parental rights case in juvenile court. And then we're making this new subsection C and separating out the decisions that a guardian ad litem would make in other contexts. And we're allowing them to make decisions about the adoption of the child, which would include signing what's called the release and surrender, which is basically the consent to adoption for a parent, and to also enter into agreements, which are post-adoption contact agreements under ORS 109-305. So we have now, instead of just one subsection that only referred to the adoption decisions, two subsections there. I hope that helps a little bit. And then we've renumbered the two remaining subsections there. Those two provide that the guardian ad litem controls the litigation and provides direction to the parent's attorney on the decisions that would ordinarily be made by a parent in a case. And lastly, we made it a requirement that the guardian ad litem inform the court if the parent no longer needs a guardian ad litem. Then the next section, subsection 4, gives guidance to guardians ad litem about how they are to make these very difficult decisions on behalf of these incompetent parents. And what we wanted to communicate was that they needed to stand in the parent's shoes. And so the standard is that the guardian ad litem make these decisions consistent with what the guardian ad litem believes the parent would decide if the parent did not lack substantial capacity. subsection 5 then is deleted. First three lines of subsection 5 are deleted, and the third amendment from the dash 1 amendments, which starts on line 17 of the dash 1 amendments, is inserted there, so that the beginning of subsection 5 reads, "The parent's attorney shall follow directions provided by the guardian ad litem on decisions that are ordinarily made by the parent," and then "the parent's attorney shall," and we're back to the language on line 32, "shall inquire at every critical stage in the proceeding as to whether the parent's competence has changed, and if appropriate, shall request removal of the guardian ad litem." Mm-hmm. And so then subsection 6 provides a privilege for the guardian ad litem, since the guardian ad litem is in the same position as a parent, and a parent would have a privilege with their attorney. The guardian ad litem also needs to have that privilege, and the guardian ad litem needs to have a privilege between the guardian ad litem and the parent as well, because they will be obtaining confidential and privileged information from the parent. And this section is based on existing, is drafted similar to other existing privilege statutes. So when we already talked about subsection 4, subsection 5, the only amendment is on page 4 at lines 28 through 30, and provides for a copy of a summons in a termination case to also be provided to a guardian ad litem. Subsection 6, the amendment is similar and provides, and is on the top of page 5 at lines 3 to 5, and provides for a guardian ad litem to receive a summons in a jurisdictional case. In section 7, we are exempting guardians ad litem from child abuse reporting for any information they receive from the parent who they're representing. And again, under similar circumstances, attorneys are exempted from child abuse reporting as well, so we felt that that was necessary. In Section 8, the amendment is at the bottom of page 5 at lines 44 through the top of the next page, and this is an amendment that Legislative Council put in. That really doesn't have anything to do with this bill.
But get past that. We are familiar with those.
Section 9, the amendment is at lines 34 to 35 and provides that a guardian ad litem gets discovery in the case, and that's so that they have the same documentation that the other parties have to assist them in making the decisions that they are required to make in the case.
Okay, well, thank you for that thorough explanation of the bill. Are there questions from the committee, Council?
Ms. McFarland, a technical question. Do you think, and this goes to issue for the evidence code, in Section 2, Sub 4 on page 1, starting at line 23, the bill makes it clear that the rules of evidence, at least those sections of the rule of evidence, do not apply to this hearing for the guardian ad litem. And my question is it necessary for us, just as a matter of consistency, to then amend the preliminary section of the Oregon Evidence Code? If you'll recall, the Oregon Evidence Code starts out with a section that says the evidence code applies in all matters in all courts except for the following, and then lists a specific number of exceptions. I just reviewed the exceptions to see if juvenile court matters generally are accepted, and they're not. So if we pass this without amending the evidence code, there's going to be a conflict, and we may want to resolve that now.
Chair Murdoch, Mr. O'Leary, there is a very similar provision elsewhere in the juvenile code, and so we did not look at also amending the evidence code. That's certainly something that I can take back to my sub-work group and talk about whether we think we need to do that. I think we felt because there was a similar provision elsewhere and it was being treated more like an exception than, a very narrow exception rather than taking the juvenile code entirely out of the evidence code, which we don't want to do, that it was okay. But I would be happy to take another look at that.
Could you do that? And if we need an amendment, I agree we don't want to take the entire juvenile system out of the evidence code, but perhaps if a very narrow exception is necessary, then you could do it. Thanks for that good catch, counsel. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I think we will ask for that information to be gathered on the compliance with the evidence code, and we will close the... Oh, I'm sorry. We have one more witness. Two more witnesses. Lane Barlow. Lane, you in here?
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Lane Barlow with the Oregon Men's Association. I'll keep this short and sweet. Our only concern about Senate Bill 230, how putative fathers are treated by this and other bills, and actually we're going to go into depth on that Senate Bill 234, and because the definitions of putative fathers are being affected by that bill more than this one. So.
Okay. Thank you for coming. With that, we will. Are there questions from the committee? With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 230 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 229. Councilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 229 is the measure that clarifies the definition of caregiver relationship, both for purposes of the dependency statutes as well as the statute regarding who may intervene in a juvenile dependency matter.
Welcome. Good afternoon, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Linda Guss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here at the request of the Oregon Law Commission Juvenile Code Subgroup.
Thank you. Could you speak up just a little
certainly
bit? Thank you.
To speak about Senate Bill 229. Senate Bill 229 does three things. It's really a correction or cleanup bill, a technical kind of cleanup. The three things that Senate Bill 229 does is that it changes the reference in the Juvenile Code Placement Preference Statute from child-parent relationship to caregiver relationship, which mirrors what's currently in the Juvenile Code Intervention Statute. That change in the bill is found in Section 1. Senate Bill 229 also changes the statutory citation in the Juvenile Code Placement Preference Statute from ORS 109-119 to ORS 419-B116, which again is related to changing the reference from child-parent relationship to a caregiver relationship. And again, that change is reflected in Section 1 of the bill. And finally, Section 2 of the bill changes the length of time a caregiver relationship must exist before a caregiver can qualify as an intervener in a juvenile court case. So those are the three technical changes that the bill makes to clean up some things that were missed over the last two sessions when the intervention bill was originally enacted, and then some additional changes were made to that bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions for you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lane, you're signed up for this. Did you want to do this one or wait?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Lane Bartle with Oregon Men's Association. Our concern is with this bill is a little more elaborate than Senate Bill 230. Our main objection is that preferences begin being given over caregivers, over parents. In Troxell v. Granville, the U.S. Supreme Court made it clear that parents would be given a presumption of fitness, and of course we mean except for obvious obvious examples. But there's a lot of dads out there in legal limbo, and a few mothers too. You're in the court, you don't have custody of the kid, and you're fighting to see your child. You got a restraining order on you, you're working through the process of paternity, et cetera. In the meantime, you're fighting every step of the way in the course to see your kids. And that's the reality of the custody versus parenting time in this state. What we got here is that you are rewarding a party who hinders and actively obstructs a potentially good parent from being involved in the child's life, and this is punishment for that. We are not offering amendments on this bill, but as you consider in work session, we just ask you to keep that in mind. That's all I have.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you. Okay, with that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 229 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 231. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 231 will require the court in delinquency cases to create a list of identifying records that the court considered but which were not admitted as exhibits. I believe that this is specific to what's known as the court's social file, and it makes those matters part of the record for appeal.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice, and I'm also a member of the Oregon Law Commission's Juvenile Code Work Group. And I'll be talking about both Senate Bill 231 and the -1 amendments, and I think I can, in a very summary and non-technical way, explain what we're doing here. ORS 419A 255 governs the confidentiality of juvenile court records. That statute now tells us basically what records and information in the juvenile court are confidential, who gets access to them, and what those folks or agencies can do with that information and material when they get it. The core provisions of that statute have not been changed in substance since 1959. And as Mr. Travis and others today have outlined, society and juvenile court practice has changed considerably. Senate Bill 231 and the -1 amendments address and, I believe, resolve three specific problems that need current attention. The first is, as counsel outlined, there's no requirement now that any court or any entity related to the court maintain or keep what's called social file materials. These are reports and materials related to a juvenile delinquent or dependent's social progress and history, which the juvenile court relies on in making its determinations. Very often these reports and other materials are submitted not as exhibits, but just to inform the court. Under current practice, because there is no entity designated to maintain those records, used to be the juvenile department, which was part of the juvenile court, but that's no longer true. But as a result of that omission, practice across the state for preserving these materials is just a patchwork of variation. In some counties, an informal survey we did about a year ago revealed that some counties are shredding these materials because they don't have the capacity to maintain them. What we've done, and this is Section 2 of 231, is basically, I think, resolved this problem in a pragmatic way. Section 2 leaves to the local court the method by which these materials are going to be maintained. It requires the court to cause them to be available and to make a list of the materials on which the court relies. That language was worked out with the Judicial Department because we realize that they're under a budget crunch like everyone else. And this will let the courts who now maintain all of those records all the time to continue to do that if they want to, but the courts that don't have the staff or the capacity to just maintain those records that are going to be material to an appeal in the case. Under the current law, the way it is now, appeals are delayed, materials are lost, and this costs the state money and time. The second of the three problems that the bill and the amendment are designed to address is, under current law, agencies and entities that are involved in juvenile court cases and as parties have a right to access these materials are not covered by 419A-255, the district attorney, the OIA, DHS, and the juvenile department. The second part of that is there's no provision in 419A255 that authorizes those entities to share among themselves that information for purposes related to their official duties in the case. Section 4, which is in the -1 amendment, gives that authorization. And the final problem that the bill addresses, and this is Section 3 of Senate Bill 231, it clarifies whether a juvenile court transcript is part of the confidential materials in the juvenile court. There are two reasons that this is a necessary change. First of all, it's usually the court clerk or someone in the juvenile department who has to respond to requests for this information. We think, and folks sort of on the ground think, that the statute should be as clear as it can about what's confidential and what isn't. In May of 2003, in a public records order, the Attorney General concluded that transcripts under the statute are confidential. What this section does, Section 3 of 231, is make that clear and make that part of the statute. I want to add that that change to the statute does not mean that the juvenile court hearings are closed. The hearings themselves are open, consistent with Oregon Constitution Article 1, Section 10. So those are the three problems that this standalone legislation addresses. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, Sarah, could you give us some idea of what you're talking about on social record? Are these like anecdotal, hearsay, inadmissible evidence? What are we talking about here?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, when the court makes a disposition, that is, when the court, after the court has found jurisdiction, after it's had a hearing or trial on the petition, then the court has to make a separate decision what's to be done with the child or with the youth, both delinquency and dependency case. The current statute allows in a broader range of evidence for that kind of hearing than for the trial on the petition. Under the current statutes, for example, the rules of evidence do not apply. And so both the agencies, DHS, OIA, and also other entities can submit psychological evaluations and other material related to the youth. There is a hearing at which the information in those reports and proceedings can be challenged. So it's not a matter where the material is submitted without review and consideration by all the parties. Everybody's playing by the same rule. This point, the social reports we're talking about also primarily refer to the reports that DHS has to submit in these neglect and abuse cases. They're required by federal law and state law to submit the reports to the court. Often these proceedings are disposition review proceedings to see how the child is doing and how the parents are doing with what they've been ordered to do by the juvenile court. Right now, many times those reports and also the reports submitted in rebuttal to those are not part of the record that comes up on appeal for the Court of Appeals to review. And so many times those appeals are delayed because everybody has to track down that information. But I think the focus of your question is, does this mean things that go in without challenge or without an opportunity to rebut? And that's not correct. Everybody gets a copy of everything that goes to the court. So what we're talking about is, in this case, if it's a report that the court relies on in making a decision, then the court makes a note of that. I relied on this court report, and then that becomes part of the record should there be an appeal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 231 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 234. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 234 would modify provisions in the Dependency Code relating to putative fathers, and it would also modify a separate statute that relates to the establishment of paternity to make those statutes use consistent language and definitions.
Thank you very much. And to the extent that you can accomplish brevity, it would be appreciated. We've got a lot of witnesses signed up for the next bill.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. I am Leslie Harris.
I'm before you today in my role as the reporter for the work group that prepared this bill for the Oregon Law Commission. In my other life, I am a law professor at the University of Oregon, where I teach with Madam Chairwoman's wonderful sister.
Well, thank you.
By way of background, just to explain to you a little bit about what this topic is, sort of to give you a little bit of context, this bill concerns the treatment in juvenile court proceedings, particularly dependency proceedings, of men who are biological children, the biological fathers of children, but who are not married to those children's mothers. Those mothers may be simply unmarried, or they may be married to someone else. And so that's the topic of this. What do you do with these guys who are the biological fathers, but who aren't the husbands of the moms? We call these putative fathers. Not punitive fathers, putative fathers.
Thank you for clearing that up.
Beg your pardon?
Thank you for clearing that
up. Yes, my students always call them punitive. That's why I learned to do that. These fathers, some of them have got rights, constitutional rights, notwithstanding the fact that they are not the husbands of the mothers of the children. And I should also say they are also fathers whose paternity has not otherwise been established. And in Oregon, it is possible for a man who is not the husband of the mother of the child to establish his paternity through affiliation proceeding on a paternity suit, or by the mother and he going together and signing a document that acknowledges that he is the father, or by some other legal proceeding. If any of those things has happened, we're not talking about him here fundamentally. We're talking about these other guys who haven't done anything to establish their legal paternity.
Ms. Harris, maybe I'm under a misunderstanding, because if a woman is married and she has a child, there's a presumption under the law that that child is the product of her husband, even though it may not be her husband's child, and there's nothing that can be done about that to change that, is that?
That's not totally true. If at the time the child was conceived, the husband and wife were cohabiting, and he was not impotent or sterile, you're right. But if either one of those preconditions is not true, the presumption is rebuttable. And the time when this would come up in this bill would be when a woman is married but not living with her husband. I mean, it might have been a short time or it might have been a long time, and she's never gotten a divorce and she's had a baby with someone else.
Okay.
Anyway, these men may nevertheless have constitutionally protected rights, because in fact they have attempted to or succeeded in establishing a meaningful relationship where they take parental responsibility. And so the law has to, at a minimum constitutional level, the law has to protect them. Most of the time, for most of the purposes of Oregon law, this is all dealt with in Chapter 109. We are here talking about the juvenile code, and that's the focus of what we're doing. And the reason is that it's not uncommon in juvenile court proceedings for there to be uncertainty about who a child's biological father is, who the child's legal father is, either because the mother's unmarried and there's never been an establishment of paternity, or because there's one of these situations where she's married, but and that marriage hasn't been dissolved, but she's actually had a child with someone else. And it's important for the question of paternity to be clarified in juvenile court proceedings for two reasons. The most important reason is that the philosophy and purpose of the Oregon Juvenile Code, as I'm sure you know, is to protect the child's relationship with fit parents and to try to to help parents who've got difficulties. And that includes both parents, not just the mother, but both parents. And so if a child comes into juvenile court and the child is living with the mother but not the father, as happens not infrequently, it may be that the father is a very good and suitable parent for the child, and so you need to find that out and identify him and get him into the picture as quickly as possible in the interests of, you know, the best interests of the child. In those cases where ultimately the child protective proceeding results in the termination of parental rights suit because it's not going to be possible to reunite the child with the parent, it is important also at that point, and since the point of terminating parental rights of a child is to have the child be adopted by someone else, you can't do that if the child's still got an existing legal parent. And so you want to make sure that if that's the at the point that that case comes to that, if it does, that you've identified the child's legal parents and that you've made sure you've tried to work with them, and that if that's not going to be possible to reunify the parent and child, that you can terminate the parental rights. And so you need to have both parents, including this father in the picture there. The Oregon Juvenile Code currently includes a provision in section, I believe it's 839, that provides for notice to some of these unwed fathers. It is a paraphrase of parallel language in chapter 109. It is not an accurate paraphrase. And so that leads to the first problem this bill addresses, which is that the definition of these putative fathers who are entitled to procedural and substantive rights in juvenile court is neither constitutionally accurate. It doesn't include all the men that ought to be included in the interests of the child because they've demonstrated a commitment to their children. And so that needs to be fixed. It is also, as I've suggested, not consistent with the language in Chapter 109, and that recurs throughout the Juvenile Code. So that's the second set of problems that this bill makes an attempt to fix, is to reconcile and to make consistent the provisions in Chapter 109 and Chapter 419. And then the third problem that the bill seeks to solve is that the Oregon Juvenile Code right now does not explicitly authorize the juvenile court judge to resolve these conflicts. There's no authority that says, and the judge can decide, you know, can conduct a hearing and figure out who the kid's legal father is and make appropriate orders. And so those are the three problems that this bill solves. The three solutions, and what we've done, I will just tell you, in the report that we gave you, and Katie Garrett, who's presenting with me, will talk about this in more detail, but the report that we've given you, beginning on page 8, combines Senate Bill 234 and the amendments in dash 2 into one thing. This is sort of unofficial, but just so that you can follow it. I should tell you the reason this comes before you as 234 with amendments is just a matter of timing. The bill was pre-filed, and the work group wasn't quite finished, and so we finished, and the amendments in 234 in dash 2 are those completions. All of this has been approved by the Oregon Law Commission. So anyway, the first thing that's done is done in one particular place, which Ms. Garrett will talk to you about if you want to hear the details, clarifies the definition and revises the definition of these putative fathers who are entitled to procedural and substantive rights. And the language essentially tracks the constitutional requirements, and which is saying anyone who has demonstrated a commitment to the child and a willingness to assume parental responsibilities. It includes language which is indicative, exemplary of the kinds of conduct that might indicate that kind of commitment, but that language is not exclusive. And this was something the work group quickly agreed to. The second thing that the bill does, and this is really in the way of technical, it's a technical change, this is not a substantive change, is that in several places the bill, the existing juvenile code paraphrases parallel provisions in Chapter 109, as I've suggested, but those paraphrases are not accurate, they're not complete, and so what this bill does is say, oh, okay, quit paraphrasing Chapter 109, instead just reference Chapter 109. That way, when Chapter 109 is amended, you won't have to amend Chapter 419 also. It'll just be transparent. There are some other places, some new things that are added here with regard to establishing proceedings for establishing paternity, where we say, do it like you do in Chapter 109. And then the third thing that the bill does, the third large thing that the bill does, is to authorize the juvenile court to establish, to conduct appropriate hearings and to resolve these factual disputes about whether or not there is a
putative father who ought to be recognized as the child's legal father, requiring that appropriate notice be given and that due process be observed. So that's basically what this bill does. And now Ms. Garrett is going to talk in somewhat more detail, and then we'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. We're running into time constraints,
okay.
So the quicker you can move through it, and it's very, very important, but we're just getting a little cramped for time. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Katie Garrett. I'm an assistant attorney general, but more importantly for today, I'm the chair of the work group that worked on this bill. I just wanted to highlight real quickly that this work group was quite large and involved representatives from several different entities with several diverse interests. We did have juvenile court judges, representatives from the Juvenile Rights Project, from the Department of Justice, from the Child Support Program, private attorneys from the Family Law Bar, I think that about covers everyone, the Juvenile Court Improvement Project as well. And I would like to stress, as Professor Harris noted, that the original goal behind the bill was to put the description of putative fathers more in line with constitutional standards. But one of the things we quickly noticed when we started meeting was that the policy of including fathers was just as important as making sure we were constitutionally in line. So what I'd like to do real quickly, and noticing that you have time constraints, I'll be very brief. It's just kind of run through exactly what the bill does. And if you don't want me to do all that, that's fine, too. But there is one piece that I would like to clarify because there have been some concerns raised about it.
Why don't you do the clarification? And since you're right in town here, we can bring you back for the work session.
Okay.
If that's all right with you. Thank you.
The provision that I do want to highlight is the section of the bill that amends the definition of parent in ORS 419B004 sub 16. Now, if you're tracking along in the bill, I would actually recommend that you look at the report that has kind of the unofficial engrossed version, and that is on page 8 of the report, pages 8 and 9 of the report. What we did there, the definition includes all mothers and all legally recognized fathers rather than separating out adoptive fathers as a separate class, because adoptive fathers are also legally recognized fathers. The other thing that we did is replacing the current language in that statute that is currently as a paraphrase of ORS Chapter 109.070, which is the statute that sets out the various ways to establish paternity. Currently, as the law stands, it's paraphrasing all of those various methods for establishing paternity. What we did instead is just included a direct reference to that statute to make it clear what exactly is required to establish paternity, because the paraphrase was not exact and it did leave a few things out. And also to add a direct reference to the administrative procedures for establishing paternity. And then the second thing we did there was adding a reference to men whose paternity has been established by the juvenile court. And that's because, as Professor Harris noted, another provision of the bill, it's actually in the amendments, provides the juvenile court with authority to address issues of paternity. So that was the reason for that amendment. And then the third thing we did with that definition was clarify that men who are recognized as legal fathers under tribal law should be included as legal fathers when the Indian Child Welfare Act applies. So there really aren't any major changes to the law. This is mostly just a clarifying amendment, but there have been some concerns raised that perhaps we were taking out presumptions that exist in 109.070, and that was not at all the intent and nor the effect of these amendments.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much. I apologize for rushing through. Please say hello to my sister. Thank you. We will close. We have three opponents to this, and they are Victor Smith, Matt Minahan, and Lane Barlow.
Senator Burdick, may I just add that we will be remaining in the room for the rest of the committee hearing if you had questions after it.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
First.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lane Bartle with Oregon Men's Association. How much time do I have?
The quicker the better. I'm really sorry. Because you're in town here, aren't you?
Portland, that's close.
You're in Portland, okay.
Well, let me make this really brief here. We're circulating some written testimony here. I'm going to hit a couple highlights, and I've been talking to the proponents of the bill. There's some more amendments that need to be made. I think we can work things out, and if you can invite me back to the work session, I think we can have this all worked out.
Okay, well, we'll put your testimony in the record, and if you would maybe discuss with some of the people from the Law Commission what your concerns are. If something could be worked out, that would be great. We'd love to hear it.
Okay, if we do that, then that'll work for me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good afternoon, Senators. Victor Smith is my name. I'm president of Dads Against Discrimination. We've been in existence for more than 25, 30 years. The bill we recommend put down, trashed. I object to it. We have a lobbyist that those who are promoting the bill might see. Our lobbyist is Matt Minahan. He's sitting next to me. Matt, what do you have to offer?
Basically, we're probably in the same boat.
Could you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Matt Minahan, lobbyist for Dads America, Dads Against Discrimination. Basically, we only have issue with one portion of the bill that deals with 109.070, and that's the establishing paternity. excuse me. And how paternity is challenged. We have issue with the one-year time frame. It was brought up earlier that the presumption of paternity is challengeable. However, there's only a one-year time frame to challenge the paternity. Sorry, I just ran up the stairs plugging my meter. So basically, and we're in the same boat as the previous gentleman. We can work that issue out at the later work sessions as well.
Okay, thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 234 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 232. And audience, we got a lot of people here who want to talk, so we're going to ask, first of all, let's hear a summary from council, and then we'll bring our first three witnesses from the Law Commission up to talk about the bill, and then we're going to have to be very rigorous about having a 2 or 3 minute time limit so that everybody gets a chance to speak. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 232 would establish a responsible, except for insanity, as an affirmative defense in juvenile delinquency matters. It would also establish a juvenile panel of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. It provides for dispositional procedures for youths who have been adjudicated as having serious mental health conditions or who present a danger to themselves or others.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Welcome. For the record, my name is Kathy Berger. I'm a defense attorney in private practice with over 15 years of experience in juvenile law. In 1976, the Oregon Court of Appeals, in a case of State XRL Juvenile Department versus LJ, stated that a juvenile has the right to assert essentially what's known as the insanity defense. But the problem exists that the juvenile code is completely silent about what should happen once a juvenile tries to assert that defense. There's no information about what procedure should be used in court, and there's also nothing in the statute to talk about what disposition should occur if the youth is successful in asserting the defense. In LJ, the Court of Appeals suggested that the disposition should be dismissal of the delinquency petition and a filing of a dependency petition in treating the child as if they were a dependent. That works, and that's one of the dispositions that happens today, except for cases where you have a youth that has a serious mental illness and has committed a very serious offense, and therefore there's a public safety concern about having that youth be placed into the child welfare system where there isn't exactly a lot of services available for youth, and the child welfare system isn't really set up to handle youth that have either serious mental illness and serious public safety issues. What we tried to get to with this bill was to deal with what should happen with those youth. In looking at what was available throughout the United States, we found that actually very few states deal with this, and very few states have procedures that we thought would work well in Oregon. But we did look throughout the United States to see what other procedures were being used before we came back and decided that perhaps establishing a juvenile panel for the PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board, would be the best way to handle these juveniles in Oregon. Amy Holmes-Hain is going to go through to explain what the procedure of what the juvenile PSRB would look like. But I think it's important to note that the problem is one of making sure that we are ensuring the constitutional rights of these mentally ill children. I certainly have had the experience of representing kids that fall under that category of being a serious public safety risk and also having a serious mental health problem. And often judges are faced with the fact that they don't feel that the child welfare system can adequately protect the public, and therefore they end up adjudicating the youth and putting the youth into the Oregon Youth Authority just because that's a safer way to take care of the youth, but it's not protecting the youth's constitutional rights.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Senator Burdick and members of the committee. My name is Amy Holmes-Hain. I'm the senior deputy DA of the juvenile unit of the Multnomah County DA's office, so I supervise a team of lawyers who handle juvenile cases in Multnomah County. As Desmond Berger, I've had many years of juvenile court experience, and this is a bill that our office strongly supports. As Ms. Berger said, the current situation really provides the system with two options, neither of which is very palatable from the state's perspective. The one is to essentially ignore the fact that the youth really shouldn't be held fully criminally responsible because of the severity of their mental illness at the time of the crime, and to just go ahead and adjudicate the youth anyway because we have no other good options. That puts, I believe, the state in a very untenable position because we're really in a position of having to advocate for something that is probably not constitutionally appropriate. The other problem with that, as Ms. Berger said, is that these youths often end up in the Oregon Youth Authority Youth Correction Facility system, which is often not the most therapeutically appropriate treatment setting for this population. And youths with mental health issues of this severity can often cause problems in the institution, can be disruptive and not be the best co-clients for other youths in that institution. The other option that we have, as Ms. Berger said, is to simply treat them as dependent children, but from the state's perspective, this is not the best option either. As noted, the Child Welfare Agency is really focused on trying to protect the best interests of very young children who have been subjected to abuse or neglect or threat of harm. And if you have to put it in real-world terms, consider the example of, a 14-year-old boy who commits a serious violent sexual offense, who's also schizophrenic. That is not the kind of child that the Department of Human Services child welfare system is really designed to handle in some sort of foster home at all. Other problems from handling the case from a dependency perspective is that it really treats the case as if the youth did not break the law. It doesn't count as an adjudication, a criminal conviction, if you will, in the juvenile system. It does not carry with it certain statutory mandatory conditions that would attach to a delinquency adjudication, like sex offender registration or DNA sampling if the case were a sex case. And so And it's not a matter of public record in the way that a delinquency adjudication is. So from a community protection standpoint, this is not really an adequate option either. It sort of devalues, in our view, the reality of the fact that we have a victim in this case and that the youth should be held accountable in some way for their conduct, even if not as fully accountable as a youth who did not suffer from the same severity of mental illness. So what this bill does is it recognizes that this is a defense that already exists in the law. This is not creating new law. This is simply codifying in statute what is already the law as a matter of case law in Oregon, and recognizes that we need to have a clear process and clear dispositional options if someone is successful in asserting this defense in juvenile court. If the defense is raised, a youth's attorney has the right to obtain an evaluation of the youth. If the state doesn't agree with the findings of the defense psychologist, the state has the opportunity to get an independent evaluation of the youth. If the youth is found what we call responsible except for insanity, which is the juvenile version of the adult guilty except for insanity, it does act as an adjudication of record. It does carry with it sex offender registration and DNA sampling if it's a sex case. It places the youth under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. That's an attractive option from the state's perspective because the PSRB has a very good record of safely supervising adults who've been found guilty except for insanity in adult court. The idea would be to create a separate panel or a supplement to the existing panel that are of people who have expertise in juvenile mental health issues and adolescent development. The PSRB would review the youth's case and make decisions about what level of care and treatment the youth needs, be that secure treatment or something less than that in the community with supervision. They would be holding regular hearings, just as the adult PSRB does, and victims and DAs would have the right to be at those hearings and participate in them, which is very important to the state. And if the youth is not a danger to the community, then the court could still treat the youth as a dependent child if that were the most appropriate outcome. As you'll see by the testimony today, this is a bill that has broad, multidisciplinary support in the juvenile justice system. Our office supports it, the defense bar supports it, the bench, and many other players in the system who've struggled with this issue for many years. I think the only testimony in opposition to this bill that you'll hear today is, unfortunately, from my perspective, from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And with all due respect to the esteemed Marion County DA, who will be here to talk to you about the bill today, we wish we had the ODAA's support. I should tell you that the ODAA Legislative Committee did very graciously invite me down to meet with them to talk about the bill, and they were very respectful and had many very good questions, but still voted to oppose the bill. I think that it would have been better had the ODAA been able to collaborate with us on the development of this bill. We did ask Carolyn Norris of the ODAA some time back to send an email out to DAs across the state trying to encourage them to join with us in the work on this bill, and we unfortunately got no takers. I do think, though, that I have a bit of a sense of what the concerns are from the ODAA, and so, yes.
I'm going to ask to allow ODAA to speak for themselves.
Okay.
I need to track that versus what you sure. may say, and we can always have a rebuttal if we need it.
That would be fine. I'm happy to take further questions after you hear the negative testimony about our perspective on those concerns. The bottom line for us is that we currently have no law in an area that can be of great concern to all of us, both from a constitutional rights perspective and from a public safety perspective, and this is a good, balanced, well-supported bill that we think meets everyone's needs. I'm giving you the large county perspective. I think that it would be nice now to hear from Christina McMahon from the Deschutes County DA's office, who's here not on behalf of the ODAA, but on as a prosecutor working in a smaller county, to share her purview.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Senator Burdick and committee members. I do need to just state for the record that I am here as a person who practices in this area of law. I am not here as a representative of the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office or the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I have spent...
Could you give your name for the record, even though she already said it?
I'm sorry. It's Christina McMahon. I am a deputy district attorney assigned to the Juvenile Division of the Deschutes County District Attorney's Office, and I supervise that division. I know that you're short on time, so I just wanted to stress the point that even though I practice in an area which is very small compared to Multnomah County, we are sometimes confronted with these issues and these kids who have the types of problems that Ms. Holmes-Hain and Ms. Berger have described to you today. It's whenever this happens in our small county, we have about 150,000 people in Deschutes County now. Whenever this happens, it forces us to go into what I call the reactive crisis mode. And by that I mean there are many meetings and chambers with judges, defense attorneys, juvenile counselors, OYA people, and myself, or people in my office, trying to piecemeal together some way of dealing with these youth that somehow meets everybody's interests. And by that, I mean making sure that our community's safe, making sure that they get the treatment that they desperately need, making sure their constitutional rights are hoping that we're going to protect their constitutional rights, and hopefully not violating any ethical mandates that we're all dealing with. And that puts everyone involved in a very difficult situation, and I have to admit there have been many times where I question what we're doing, but it's sort of a lesser of two evils approach. And I also have to admit there are times I know that youth who are inappropriate for the dependency system end up going to DHS, and on the flip side of that, youth who are inappropriate for OYA end up being placed in a correctional facility because of situations as Ms. Holmes-Hain has described. So I'm supporting this bill as a person who practices in this area because I think it provides a proactive approach to dealing with an existing problem. And even if it only happens once or twice a year in Deschutes County, I can tell you it is still a crisis-type situation that ends up taking up a lot of time and energy and usually doesn't end up in a very good result. Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Counsel, did you have a question?
A quick technical question. I think Ms. Berger can probably address it, or it may be something that needs to be addressed. It was brought to my attention by a representative of the Oregon, I believe the Oregon Psychiatrists Association, with reference to Section 6 of the bill, which is on page 4. This is the section that gives the state the right to have a psychiatrist examine the child who asserts the defense. I'm looking at line 17. The language of the bill says that it is at least one psychiatrist certified or eligibly certified by the Board of Medical Examiners in child psychiatry or licensed psychologist, etc. It was pointed out to me that the Board of Medical Examiners is actually not the certifying agency, but rather the licensing agency, and that that may need to be changed one way or the other.
Madam Chair, Mr. O'Leary, that language was the language that was given to us when we consulted the psychiatrist as being the language that we should put in there. So if that language needs to be changed now, we are more than happy to change it. But I should note that it is important, however, that we leave that they're eligible to be certified. Oregon has an extreme shortage of certified child psychiatrists, and we want to make sure that it's not putting a prop that there's there are psychiatrists who are eligible to be certified or eligible
licensed,
to be licensed,
whichever,
or whatever it's supposed to be, but are not, and we want to make sure that, those are able to be used.
And I think the other issue would be that in Laurel counties, too, that it would be especially difficult to find those individuals.
That's correct.
So.
That's correct.
Thanks for that clarification. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
I know that we have some judges who are hoping to present next.
Well, you just predicted what I was about to do next.
I'm always trying to be deferential to my sisters on the bench in this situation.
Yeah, the Judiciary Committee treats judges well. So next we'll have Terry Leggett and Judge Darling, Judge Terry Leggett and Judge Darling. And I think I'll call Bob Nickel up to be a part of this panel as well. Thank you, Bob. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Yeah. Chair Burdick, Terry Leggett. I'm a judge in Marion County. Thank you for inviting us up. I'm not going to add much more except to say one thing I want to make a point of, and Judge Darling, I know, is going to ditto this. We have been on this Juvenile Code Revision Committee for 6 years, I think, and we support all the bills that are up here today. We just testify in this one because we both feel strongly that it's really needed. I was a full-time judge for 6 years, a juvenile court full-time, and Judge Darling's been doing it about that long, I think. So I'm going to say that we have examples. These are everyday examples. I don't think there's a lot of youth that fall within this that will be covered by it, and I think that's part of the prediction. But when you need it right away, yesterday, like Ms. McMahon was saying. And we're hoping that this will be very helpful in dealing with those youth. And there already is a cost. I know some people talk, but there's a cost that's already out there. It's not something new we're creating. Somebody's dealing with these youth, so they're being dealt with somewhere. So, anyway, I just want to make those points. And I'll let Judge Darling, she had been writing furiously.
Somewhere. Okay, good. If you need to get up and leave, that's
okay. Actually, both of us felt so strongly that we're clear a calendar for
you. I appreciate you coming. Thank you.
Senator Burdick, members of the committee, when I took my oath to...
You need to identify yourself.
I'm sorry. Pam Darling, Judge Clackamas County Juvenile. Been doing it for 10 years. I am the only judge on a regular basis in my county that does juvenile, and I feel very passionate about everything in juvenile, and this is but one of them. You know, when I took my oath 10 years ago to uphold the law, I thought that'd be easy. Unfortunately, in some areas, it isn't. In this particular area, I have competing laws. I have a constitution that says that this is something that children are entitled to, and statutes that don't tell me how. I don't like making up stuff as I go. I appreciate the direction that you give me from Salem, and I do my best to apply it, and I think I speak for all 158 of us, or however many there are. Certainly, I know for all the juvenile judges who get together regularly and struggle with this issue. These children have the right to this. I have, and I don't think I'm the only judge, found myself in a position where if I did not find a youth responsible for something that I did not think they were responsible for, meaning mentally responsible, that I would place that child and the community at risk. And so, I believe in a way I violated my oath and placed that youth in the custody of the youth authority in violation of that youth's rights. I'm finding that harder and harder to do. What I see in this bill is the potential to no longer have to do that and to adequately meet the needs of these youth who did not ask to be in this situation, but who are dangerous to themselves and to others. We shouldn't have victims. We shouldn't have victims of these children. But when we do, why are we continuing not to meet the needs of these kids who shouldn't have done what they did? It's not about getting them out of it. Yes, it is expensive. Court-appointed attorneys are expensive. Jury trials are expensive. I'm expensive. But we need us, I think, and I should hope you would support this bill to defend that. Daily I face young people who are 11, 12, 13, and 14 years old whose faces barely would clear this table. Some have done more serious things than others, and they sit there with a blank look on their faces. I'm trying to explain their rights to them. And then they're trying to help their lawyer have their trial. We're listening to the horrible things they did. And then my choice is either to turn them loose, turn them back to the families from which they came, which sometimes are harmful and sometimes not, or lock them up. I don't prefer the latter unless we must, and these kids do not belong there. Our prisons are full of mentally ill people. I see no reason to continue that trend for our children. And maybe if we do this right and adopt this bill, we'll have a fewer population in our prison later. Those are my comments. I would hope you wouldn't back up from the cost. I agree with Judge Leggett. We're already spending the money. We're not spending it wisely and well. And I welcome your help on this bill so that we can do a better job. And I believe further discussions with the ODAA will help us not be so divided on this issue, because I'm not so sure we are. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you. Mr. Nickel.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is in the Department of Human Services. And I've provided written testimony, which I won't read through line by line. I did want to just mention or go on record as saying the concept of this bill is something that we very strongly support. We recognize that there are children who really need this level of legal disposition and then, of course, the treatment in the hospital or in the community, following that under close supervision. I In my role as administrator for mental health and addiction services, I have one hat, but I do want to comment that there are other parts of the department that needs to understand a little bit more about what the intent of the legislation would be, particularly for young children and adolescents who have developmental disabilities. So the persons with seniors and persons with disabilities, that particular cluster within the Department of Human Services, would like to have some additional discussion about how this legislation might impact developmentally disabled kids. And so any potential fiscal impact, I think from our part, we would need to understand just a little bit more about that. So aside from that, I just want to go on record as saying the department is very supportive of the concept. And just because we still have some questions about fiscal impact, we're taking a neutral stance until we can hopefully be able to be formally supportive of the bill itself.
Thank you very much. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Next, we will take Walt Beglau from the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the Senate Subcommittee on Judiciary.
Actually, we're a committee.
You are the committee.
Yeah,
okay.
There's all four of us at the moment, but others will be in.
The slim committee. My name is Walt Beglau. I'm the district attorney of Marion County, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I feel like I've drawn the short straw today. The executive committee of the District Attorneys Association opposes Senate Bill 232. And I would like to give due respect to Senator Brown, Judge Darling, and Judge Leggett, whom I work with in my county, and the other folks today here that have moved forward with this legislation. I also have tremendous respect for the consideration and commitment to these youths contemplated in this particular proposal. However, the simple fact is that it creates a significant bureaucratic process for a finite number of youth, as represented 10 a year, to my understanding, particularly where the current process of dependency-based solution exists. This has been the focus of the Oregon District Attorneys Association's concern. These can be handled as dependency actions. The true challenge is disposition with these youths, and the focus on us, the systemic problem of inadequate local-based supervision and community-based housing alternatives for our mentally ill youth. And perhaps it's not a footnote in this discussion. My experience has been, and this was voiced by the association, is that if you build it, they will come. There are multiple points, as I reviewed this legislation, where costs will mount. Attorney's fees, evaluation, sustaining an independent juvenile PSR board, reevaluation, state's opportunity, where money should be focused on disposition. So the proposition of the District Attorneys Association collectively is that the electives believe that dependency is the appropriate process for mentally ill children. I think that sums up the points that the executive committee asked me to bring forward today. I would note.
I did have you said that dependency, you thought dependency was the appropriate thing, but what about the point about public safety? The dependency system is really not set up to guard public safety.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think their point is well taken. There are some significantly mentally ill youths, but that if you look county to county, there are opportunities, and we are facilitating these now. For example, I spoke with the veteran in our county who said that dependency is absolutely the way to proceed for this, and we can put together alternatives to take these fairly serious, dangerous mentally ill and put together a package that works. But that our position is a fundamental question, that you move forward saying that this is where the focus should be, not in creating a vast bureaucratic process for a finite number of mentally ill children. I am not I'm keenly aware of those particular children they focus on, but it's a fundamental position we're taking.
Okay. Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we will take Dr. Keith Chang, Claire Corwin Kordowski, and Angela Kimball.
Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Claire Corwin Kordowski, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the Oregon Chapter of the National Association of Social Workers, NASW. I'm a licensed clinical social worker with 17 years of experience working with youth. NASW is in Oregon is a professional association for social workers with nearly 1,800 members statewide. I won't repeat a lot of the information that's already been presented, but I did want to bring up one thing that I haven't heard today. The Oregon Youth Authority conducted a mental health gap assessment in 2002, which found that 62% of the 1,070 youth in their correctional facilities were diagnosed with at least one mental health disorder. The survey found that 8% of juvenile offenders in closed custody facilities suffer from serious psychiatric and/or developmental disorders, while many of these youth would not be found guilty except for mental disease and defect. Under the proposed statute, it is important to recognize that youth with severe mental illnesses are ending up in correctional facilities even when they would not be considered culpable for their crimes if they were adults. I retired from the Multnomah County Mental Health Division, where I worked as a case manager for children with severe and complex mental disorders. I'm all too familiar with the barriers families can face in getting help for their seriously ill child. Unfortunately, the juvenile justice system has become the mental health treatment provider by default. NASW Oregon urges this committee to pass this long overdue piece of legislation so that justice can be served for the youth in Oregon who are most in need of our understanding and our help. Again, NASW asks you to remedy this very unfortunate flaw in Oregon's law by supporting Senate Bill 232. Thank you for your consideration of this important matter and for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Okay, who's next? Angela.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here representing the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. I've been asked to come to you and reflect their neutral position, basically reflecting the fact that there's a range of opinions among mental health directors. I am asked to suggest to you that one of the concerns is the thought that a youth might be institutionalized with a label for an indefinite period of time if this legislation were to be passed, as well as the concern that there are fiscal impacts to the system that aren't necessarily adequately addressed. On a different end of the spectrum, we have mental health directors who say that they totally support the concept of a juvenile PSRB that is necessary, that kids are now placed in correctional facilities when they should be in mental health facilities and must now plead guilty or be found within the jurisdiction of the court for services. So, again, I'm just reflecting a range of opinions from the community mental health program directors. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you could just switch hats for a moment. You're my constituent, and I know that you've been an advocate as a parent of a mentally ill adolescent who has interacted with the criminal justice system. And as a parent, how do you feel about this issue?
As a parent, I think this legislation is long overdue and entirely necessary. Not only has my own son been in contact with the juvenile justice system, so have the sons and daughters of numerous friends and people that I've met as an advocate. And what I can tell you now is that by having appropriate treatment and supports, my son is now applying for college and doing very well. However, I do have friends who
whose sons have graduated from McLaren and are now in our adult criminal justice system. I do believe that without having this opportunity to provide alternatives to incarceration, we are being fiscally not conservative and instead spending needless resources and contributing to long-term disability.
Thank you very much.
Chair.
Senator Walker.
I would like to say, Ms. Kimball, that was the most refreshing testimony I've heard today. I've heard a lot of testimony, and I've appreciated all of it, but that one comes right here from your heart, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Senator Walker. I can tell you that Ms. Kimball has worked long and hard on these issues, and I really appreciate it. Dr. Chang.
Madam Chairman, committee members, my name is Keith Chang. I'm the current president of the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. There's only about 100 members statewide, so there are a few of us, and I happen to be one of the board certified ones. I practice all over the state. I see patients in Deschutes County, Corvallis, the Portland area, and my colleagues would like to say that we want to support the issue of getting children the best possible treatment. So if a child was having a mental health problem, well, if a child was having a medical problem, you'd probably want them to see a pediatrician rather than an internist. And to have review of cases by experts in the field in a separate PSRB panel is what the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry is really interested in. Obviously, with people who are more expert in the field, you get more effective recommendations, more appropriate treatment. That'll end up with less inertia in the system, more accurate and assessments with regarding safety and better monitoring. On a personal note, I was really struck by Judge Darling's testimony is that I have been in one of those situations where I personally was caring for a minor who was in need of treatment. They were subsequently placed in a dependency kind of situation rather than in a psychiatric review board where they would have been better served. And subsequently, because of inadequate placement, there was an accidental homicide that occurred. So it really does place judges in this hard position. Do I place them in the system, or do they go out in the community? So I think with a panel that would help give them better ability to take care of these situations. I know time's short, so I just want to cut to the other item that I think that people talk about here, but I feel strange that I'm going to talk about money, and that is that actually, with new practices and evidence-based interventions now in child psychiatry, we actually may be able to save money if you get a very informed panel. Let me give you an example. The Mental Health Division, in collaboration with a nonprofit organization, moved a state hospital unit into a nonprofit organization. The length of stay was cut in half. The amount of cases seen was doubled. And so, you know, changing the culture helped develop a system that didn't take as much time, didn't spend as much money, and could serve more more children in Oregon. And I think the same potential lies if we had a very active psychiatric review board for children, is that the potential is you could save money. And the flip side is that I also have been involved or talked to colleagues of kids who have languished in facilities because people just don't know what to do with them. And at $600 to $700 a day, I mean, that's quite a bit of money, too. So I just want the members of the committee to think that there's a possibility, actually, of saving money or at least serving more kids by creating a juvenile panel for the PSRB. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions in this panel? Thank you very much. We have just a minute or two left. Mary Claire Buckley from the Psychiatric Security Review Board is here. Did you want to add anything to that, Mary Claire? It's been an interesting discussion. I want to thank all the Law Commission people who worked so hard on the bills that we've heard today. It's been a very good hearing. We've learned a lot. and we will continue to work forward on these issues. But for now, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 232 and adjourn Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you.